UVic Oral History Program interview with Flight Lieutenant Ken Pask, recorded on 23rd November 2005 at Victoria, British Columbia, interviewed by Sunil Karad. Tape 1, side 1. Hey, we're just going to start with what year you were born and where you were born.
I was born in Alfreton, England, in August, on the 29th of August in 1922.
And what was your childhood like there? What was your childhood like? Did you, were your parents very strict? Did you go to summer camp?
Oh no, my home childhood was, quote, normal. Some fun and occasional some sadness, usually of my own development.
Is there any military history in your family?
Any
military history in your family?
My dad was in the army in World War II for 48 hours, at which point they discovered that he was an engineer and classified him as exempt from military service because his services would be of more value back where he was working. So no, we don't have any military history.
So you were the first of your family to be in the military?
To be involved to any degree.
What year did you join the Air Force?
Right at the very beginning of 1941. January, February, something like that.
Why did you choose the Air Force over the Army or the Navy?
Oh, I mean, there's no choice, is there? I mean, which would you rather do? Flying around in those things, or slugging it through trenches, or sticking your neck out in the middle of the Atlantic with all the U-boats trying to sink you. No, I mean, I developed an interest in flying as a schoolboy, and then, as a matter of fact, there were several groups of veterans from World War I pilots who were now trying to find something useful to do. I guess employment was pretty lousy after World War I. I wouldn't know, but that's my understanding. And these World War I pilots, most of them bought one of the military planes, and then they chummed up together and they would form what they call them flying schools. Schools, I think that's what they called them. They traveled all over the country and they'd find a patch of land somewhere and they'd have their colleagues with them. They'd have perhaps as many as 6 or 8 World War I aircraft. And they would put on demonstrations and so on and so forth. And also, for a price, you could go and take a flight.
Oh, really?
And I won a contest that entitled me to a flight free of charge. And when I came down from that, I said to my brother who accompanied me, "That's what I want to do." And then the war came along and that solved that problem.
Now, as the war did come, did you feel it was like your patriotic duty to serve, or did you, was that just a chance for you to be able to fly a plane?
Well, you mean like, why did I join up at all, really?
Yeah, basically.
Well, I can't claim that it was through any great sense of duty, so much as the fact that all of my school chums were, well, the vast majority of them anyway, had joined the Army or the Navy. Those who weren't thinking too long, or joined the Air Force. And I was actually in a military exempt job I was a pharmacist, in pharmacy at the time. But even so, you could volunteer to not take advantage of the exemption, mm-hmm. which is what I did, and I joined the Air Force.
And where did you train to become a pilot?
In Britain and in Canada, different levels of flying training. The very beginning, initial elementary stuff was in Britain at Cambridge, and then the more exciting and more important periods, at the end of which I got my pilot's wings, mm-hmm. were in Canada at Penhold in Alberta.
So you joined the RAF or the RCAF?
I joined the RAF.
And then you came to Canada?
Then
And what was the training like? Like, how long did it last? Was it difficult?
Well, let me see. I got my wings. Finally started actual flying training. I think it was in... we've got it here. In May of 1941. And I got my wings just about Christmas time, 1941.
How long? So you started in early 40?
I joined the Air Force I joined the Air Force in early 1941.
Oh, so it didn't take that long to get
And, you have to go through some ground training. You have to learn how to march, how to salute, all sorts of useful stuff that you never use again. And May, about 3 months, 4 months after I joined up, that I actually got onto the pilot's training course.
Did you find it difficult, the training?
It was fun.
Was it? How about all the written stuff, like the tests and all the kind of examinations you had to do?
Well, in the early stages, right the way through until you get your wings, your training was in two sections. You got ground school, and then you got flying training. Ground school was teaching you things like navigation and a little bit about machine guns and aircraft engines and so forth, just enough to confuse you, not enough to be of any value. And theoretically, you would do a period of ground training and then go and put that ground training into effect while you were learning to fly. Mm-hmm. That was a theory.
Okay. At any point during the training, obviously you love to fly, so you're keen at it. So were you thinking, I'm going to have to go to war pretty soon, or were you looking forward to it?
Neither one. Many of us have talked about this a few times over a beer, and we said, it wasn't until I got on a squadron and went on operational duty that I began to think, this could be dangerous. But up until that point, I don't think any of us really, well, I can't speak for everybody, obviously, but among the friends I have in the Air Crew Association, nobody admitted anyway to thinking about the fact that our training was going to end up by being shot at. And so forth.
Everyone was just really keen about flying. So.
Yeah. There was only one thing in our mind. I got to make it through to the end. I got to get my wings.
So while you were in training, y'all obviously stayed in barracks. What was that like? What was the atmosphere inside, like during leisure time when you guys weren't training?
The atmosphere in the...
Like just with the men, like the camaraderie.
We've here again, among the aircrew guys that I know today, we still talk about it, and it was an unconscious thing that happened, but you developed a very strong bond with your colleagues who were going through training with you. When we shared our experiences and so on and so on, and well, in fact, we talk today about that very special bond. Mm-hmm. And it still exists, mm-hmm. perhaps way under the surface now, but it was very strong.
So when you got shipped over, like after your training, over to, you went straight to the Far East?
I went back to Britain. And that was in January 1942 that I got back to Britain. And that was still a period when there was a lull in the war. Never really did understand it, and we got to do all sorts of things. We were sent to what was called an operational training unit, where we would have mock battles with each other. And we fire at targets on the ground. One of the guys, especially if he'd misbehaved, would be towing a drogue for the day behind his aircraft, and we would shoot at that. keep his rear end warm. And then there was a period of time actually where I got sent, to my complete dismay, to a glider flying training school to tow gliders. You can imagine anything more dull. And I was there for about 3 months before I finally got on my way and did operational training again, and advanced flying training, and then at the end of that, I was posted to the Far East.
So advanced flying training, does that just mean that you're the better of?
Well, there, see, we started out the war with aircraft that were actually, some of them were actually obsolete, but the vast majority of them were not yet obsolete, but they were obsolescent. And so today you might be flying a training plane, let's say a Master, and it'd be Mark 1, the very first one. In the meantime, somebody would have developed some improvements on it, and had all these improvements put into the Master, and now became a Master Mark II. So that, and the Mark II was an advance over a Mark I. So the advanced flying that we did was a combination of proving that we had learned what we were supposed to have learned, and also being up to date with the aircraft we were flying.
What did you actually think of the British Spitfire and the equipment, say, compared to the German or the Japanese?
I felt sorry for them, for the Germans.
You think yours, the British? Oh,
there wasn't a better fighter anywhere in the world than the Spitfire. There were some enemy, like that fella up there, that's a Japanese, we called them Oscar, they're Zeros. They were a pretty nifty aircraft, but they didn't. We could, and we did outfly them, outshoot them.
So you feel the British Spitfire was the best, basically the best plane out there, best for its job?
The Spitfire was unquestionably, and I'm not taking it away from the Hurricane, mind you. The Hurricane was also a very, very nice aircraft, if I could use that term. Mm-hmm. But we had some advantages.
So would that improve your confidence, say if you're in a dogfight, knowing, or even if when you're heading out to a mission, saying, knowing that you have the best aircraft?
Well, it was a lesson you either learn quite quickly or you perished. The very first time that I got into a bit of an encounter, and I found myself mimicking what we had done at the operational training unit, and then I suddenly realized, hey, this guy's shooting at me, he wants to kill me, for Pete's sake. So I'd best smarten up here and do something. And you quickly became very aggressive, mm-hmm. because it was self-preservation. Mm-hmm. Either him or me. And I know it's going to be him.
So you obviously didn't have trouble focusing on the mission at hand.
Nothing else. There was no room in your mind for anything else except what you were doing. I mean, it wasn't like sitting there driving a car where your mind can wander off and admire the scenery and so forth. Mm-hmm. You were concentrating totally from the moment you started up, took off, until you came back down again. You were totally concentrating. If you weren't, you didn't survive. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
Now, my understanding that the role of tactical air power is to either escort bombing missions or protect, I guess is the word, to other missions.
That's right.
Now, a lot of these would be low-flying missions where you'd be pretty close to the terrain, mm-hmm. and that could be pretty dangerous. So how would you react or compensate to that danger of flying so low to the ground?
Low-flying, except on operations, was severely frowned upon by the Air Force. And if you were caught low flying, and I'm talking about making the leaves come off the top of the trees, mm-hmm. you could be in deep doo-doo. A lot depended on the commanding officer. Some of them were, especially those that had been in the Air Force for many years, they were peacetime, and there's only one rule, and that's the rule that's written in the book. The guys who were wartime and moved along, they'd wag their finger at you, but they, because low flying was that was a real thrill.
So you obviously had experience in low flying?
Oh Lord, yes.
Was that during missions?
Lots of times when you're coming back home and you were still intact and you created some disaster behind you and so forth, lots of times you just to sort of relax yourself and get down there and start going home, mm-hmm. but start weaving around, start playing games with your number two and so forth.
Just kind of relax from what?
A bit of a relaxation, really. And yet, on the other hand, you weren't relaxed because you really have to concentrate. But it was a different sort of concentration, I suppose.
We talked earlier, and you mentioned that you were in many dogfights. What was that like, fighting Japanese fighters, knowing that you had the better plane? And what was it just like being in a dogfight when you're on a mission?
Well, speaking personally, and each man has to speak personally to that question, but the fact that I was convinced that I was in the better position, that me and this aircraft that I had called the Spitfire was superior. Not in flying skills, that pilot might be very skillful, but as to what he could do with his plane and what I could do with mine, left me with an edge. And that was, gave you a lot of confidence.
And how many planes did you actually shoot down in dogfights?
Not very many, actually. See, the when we got to Southeast Asia Command and got to Imphal, at that time, the Japanese were sending a lot of their Oscars, their Zeros, all the way up Burma. They were stationed primarily in the Mandalay area, and they'd come on up and were concerned with destroying aircraft on the ground and with, of course, attacking the army, the Indian and the British army. So in those days, yes, there were other fighter aircraft. They weren't escorting anybody. They were just up there to create havoc. But the any other pilot listens to this, he'll say, boy, that's a good line shoot, but it's the truth. And that is, and it's recorded in history, that not very long after we got up there, we were the first or the second, I'm not sure which, Spitfire squadron to get up there into Imphal.
Really?
Prior to that, the poor buggers had been flying obsolescent aircraft with a ceiling that was nothing. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese could be above them and just come down and shoot at them. That must have been terrible. I didn't have anything to do with that. It was before I got to the squadron. But when I got to the squadron, I can imagine the... the stories that the Japanese pilots got back home with, they said, you know, what was that that came at us? Because they really didn't do very well. And then, very shortly after that, the activities down in the South Pacific with the American Air Forces and the Army too, of course, and their Navy, they were really concentrating on getting to Japan. They wanted to invade Japan. That was the bottom line of the story. But the Japanese, in their wisdom, recalled just about all of their aircraft from Burma. And we had control of the skies.
Not really.
We had total control of the skies. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, there'd be a reconnaissance aircraft show up, Japanese reconnaissance aircraft. And he'd have maybe a couple of Zeros escorting.
Would you be sent after that?
They never got home, you know, because we could do. Mm-hmm. I don't want to sound very cocky about this, because it wasn't, you know, it was a serious business. And we lost our guys, too. Our guys got shot down. Some of my close friends got shot down. But after we got control of the air, we were given a new role of Army support. And what we did then was, on a dawn-till-dusk basis, if the Army found, I'm not familiar with Army, I think they called them platoons, I'm not sure. But anyway, a group of Army guys would be pinned down somewhere, usually by artillery fire from a couple hundred yards away, maybe. Mm-hmm. And maybe also some Japanese machine gunners up on a bit of a hill or whatever. And they were trapped and they couldn't get out of this. So they'd call us and we would go in. Get rid of them.
Would that involve a lot of low flying, or would that just be from they give you a coordinates? And
oh no, they give us coordinates.
And you just fire that in.
No, no, we went to the coordinate, and we would actually have to see the enemy, spot them, and then you dive in on them, and so on. And that's primarily where our losses were, because it's one thing to have an Oscar somewhere around who's firing two or four machine guns of roughly the same 303 size as ours. And then we got 20 millimeter cannons as well later on. But it's one thing to have an enemy aircraft firing at you from 50 yards away or whatever, closer than that probably. But it's another thing altogether to be sticking your nose down and diving into an area that's manned by artillery guns and machine guns and Bofors guns. It's different.
So when you went on, say, those missions where you had to help out that platoon that's pinned down, would you think about that one more so than you thought about a dogfight?
Well, there were no dogfights anymore.
So once the air... I mean, like, would you compare the two?
Of the two, if I was given the choice, I think I'd go into an air-to-air combat. I got shot down by ground fire.
What year was that?
But I was obviously survived.
Yeah.
That was in 1944, I think it was.
Whereabouts did you get shot down?
Roughly 25 miles southwest of Mandalay. I don't know how familiar you are.
That's in the northern part of the river, I believe.
Mandalay, the... What's that going?
And so from your...
here's something that I used. I was talking to a bunch of people about it. This is Burma.
Just to the east of India.
This is Burma down. This is Assam. And then there's Imphal.
Okay.
It's just actually closer to the border than that shows. And right where there's this bend in the river here, that's where Mandalay... Well, it is written in. That's where Mandalay...
Okay, so in the northeast...
Well... And I was down around here, southwest of Mandalay.
Okay. And so when you got shot down, did you have to, like, ground survival? Like, how long were you in that for?
I must admit that was a little bit twitchy, as the saying goes. Because, well, just the two of us, I had a number two flying with me. We just finished attacking Japanese army positions. I'm quite sure we were pretty effective. Mm-hmm. And it was just as we were pulling away from there that I got hit. Mm-hmm. And I kept going for a little bit, but not very far actually, and caught fire. So I jumped out. But I landed right on 50 yards out from a little Burmese village. Mm-hmm. And this man came running out. Now, at that particular time, in fact, all the time, as you were going south down through Burma, recapturing what the Japanese had captured, mm-hmm. a lot of the Burmese had been given a pretty bad time of it by the Japanese. Either put into forced labor or whatever. Some of them were, but there was not a lot of love lost between them and with a lot of the Burmese people. And I'm sorry to say this, but it's a fact of life. It's recorded in history that many of them chose to join what was called the Burmese Liberation Army and fought alongside the Japanese, with the Japanese.
Oh, really?
Adopted their objective, which was to get the British out of Burma. Mm-hmm. So, and now, as a result of the Battle of Imphal and the Burmese, the Japanese army was being pushed southwards through Burma. There was never any real definite front line. There were a series of battles going on. And if you formed them up, it would be a zigzag line, like so and so. It was never a clearly defined, like I'm in the British zone here, but if I cross over the hall, I'll be in. It was never that clear. Mm-hmm. And so you never really knew whose side the Burmese were on, because after the Japanese had been forced to retreat, then a lot of them turned around and said they wanted to join the Indian Army and fight against the Japanese. They were told to stuff it. But you didn't know for sure. And that was the first thought that crossed my mind when I saw this guy running towards me, and behind him a bunch of other guys. Whose side is this guy on? Mm-hmm. What could I do?
Yeah.
I had a Smith & Wesson's revolver pistol, that's all I had. And to say I was concerned would be a bit of an understatement. But